Coleman v. Milwaukee Board. Ms. Hines.
Good morning. May it please the court, we're here today to discuss a lawsuit that was filed in August of 2000. Ms. Coleman had that innocent complaint served on the Milwaukee Board of School Directors within the 120-day time for service under Rule 4J2, and immediately following the end of the 120-day period for service, the board filed the motion to dismiss the complaint, citing Section 119.12(2) of the Wisconsin statute, indicating that both the board president and the superintendent had to be served. So rather than wait around for the district court to rule on that, we immediately had the superintendent of schools served as well, a period of about 20 days after the end of the period for service.
Well, I don't understand why you waited to the 115th day. You gave a reason about consolidation. I didn't understand that.
Well, Your Honor, this case is the first of two or three lawsuits that have been and will be filed by my client against the Board of School Directors.
Why don't you just file one lawsuit?
Well, Your Honor, the nature of the EEOC proceedings required that we file separate charges of discrimination and follow up on those with a separate notice of right to sue for each.
Okay, so you had to file several suits. Now, what does that have to do with the delay in service?
We were waiting to serve the first lawsuit while the second administrative charge made its way through the EEOC.
Why?
Because we eventually wanted to consolidate all of the charges into one lawsuit.
Well, you can consolidate them, but why not serve? I don't understand that.
Well, how would
consolidation be affected by prompt service?
Well, in this particular case, we wanted to consolidate the suits in our opportunity to first amend the complaint before the defendant had filed a responsive pleading, so we could do so as a matter of right, as opposed to waiting until perhaps halfway through the lawsuit and then run the risk that the district judge would find.
What does that have to do with whether you file on the first day or the 115th day?
Well, because, as I said, the second EEOC suit was working its way through the system.
But
and
so what? I don't understand you. So you file the suit or file or serve the complaint, and then, you know, you have other suits come down the pike. You can consolidate them. What's the 3 month or 4 month difference make?
Well, as I said, right about the time that we had the first complaint served, we were about, I think, maybe a month left to go in the EEOC 180-day process on the second charge. So we thought that after we had served the summons and complaint in the case upon which we are here today, in the time period in which the defendant had to answer, we would then receive the notice of right to sue on the second charge, immediately be able to amend the complaint in this case, and have one lawsuit without necessitating a motion to consolidate down the road, perhaps duplicating some of the discovery process. We were attempting.
So you didn't want to consolidate. You wanted to have just one suit. Is that what you're saying?
Well, essentially, yes. We were going to amend the complaint to include the subsequent EEOC charge.
And I can understand the rationale for the action you took, although I think it's risky waiting this late in the litigation. And then my question is, can't you also, if you'd served earlier, as Judge Posner suggested, couldn't you just advise the district court that there were these other things coming down the pike, and from a timing standpoint, you couldn't include them because you didn't have your right to sue letter, and put everybody on notice that this was coming, and therefore the discovery could have been broader, you know, the discovery order could have been fashioned in anticipation of these other charges?
That's correct, Your Honor, but in my estimation, that approach was riskier than the one we took here, only because it would then be up to the discretion of the court as to whether or not either to allow us to amend the complaint or
why
to
on earth would he not ask and allow you to amend the complaint?
Well, Your Honor,
what could that be about? District judges don't want to have multiple suits. They can have one suit.
Well, let me explain the different factual underpinnings of the lawsuits, and that may help the court. The case on which we're here today is primarily a race discrimination and retaliation case. The subsequent lawsuit that was wending its way through EEOC was a disability case under the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was related in time and conduct to the first lawsuit, but the subject of the lawsuit and the statutes under which it was filed was very different. And we were concerned.
Well, nothing is more common than a complaint that charges violation of multiple statutes.
And that may be, Your Honor. And trust me, when I say that if I could go back and do it over again, I would have had the complaint served earlier in this case so I could avoid being here today. But in any event, what it has now happened through the back door, what we were hoping to achieve initially. The two lawsuits have been consolidated in the district court, and they have been stayed pending the outcome of the appeal. This lawsuit and the second subsequent lawsuit that was coming from EEOC.
This lawsuit has been consolidated with another lawsuit?
What we did, Your Honor,
is... But this lawsuit has been dismissed.
What we did, Your Honor, is at the same time we filed this appeal, we also immediately refiled in the district court to preserve our right so that...
Refiled? You filed a new suit with a new number.
You didn't consolidate
this suit with anything.
No, but we filed exactly the same complaint with only an additional sentence noting the proceedings that had happened in this court. So that either way...
What's that about? What's the purpose of that?
I was attempting to preserve my client's rights either way.
How can it preserve your client's rights? I don't get it.
Well, one of the parts of the lawsuit that is before us today, it deals with 42 U.S.C. Section 1981 and the 13th Amendment. So given the longer statute of limitations on that claim, refiling that claim at least preserved my client's rights to continue that lawsuit regardless of the outcome of this suit. And in addition, there are also arguments available potentially in the district court for refiling the other lawsuit. Obviously, we would prefer to have the court reverse and remand so that the cases can be decided together as they've already been consolidated.
I don't understand. You're going to lose if you lose this appeal, you're still going to ask the district court to reinstate the case?
At the very least, the 13th Amendment and...
Well, that I understand.
Right.
But
well, I'm indicating that if there are any legal arguments available, I will use them. I don't know that there are any, but we will certainly attempt.
So if you lose here, you would just proceed on whatever that alternative claim is. You couldn't proceed on the Title VII claim. That's correct.
That's correct. And if this court agrees with... the Board of School Directors that proper service was not made within the 120 days. It's my position and cited in our briefs that all of the equities and the policy arguments and the case law favor allowing either for re-service of the complaint or for this court to determine that proper service has already been made. As I said, we moved immediately to have the superintendent served without waiting for the district court to make its decision on whether or not a motion to dismiss was proper. And so it's our position that both the board and the superintendent have now properly been served. And under case law in this circuit, in particular the case of Pandia versus Edward Hospital, the court there enumerates the four factors to be considered in this type of situation, the first being that we attempted in good faith to timely serve the complaint, which we did. Second, that the defendant did in fact receive a copy of the complaint within the 120-day period. Third, that it was not prejudiced by noncompliance with Rule 4. And fourth, that dismissal would bar the lawsuit because in this case, as you know, the Title VII portion of the lawsuit would be barred below because the very short 90-day statute of limitations has already expired.
Let me ask you this. Did you advise Judge Rand of the argument you made before us in terms of your legal strategy as to why you delayed the service?
No, I did not. And quite frankly, Your Honor, I didn't think it would be required given the case law in this circuit and the fact that we had so promptly served the superintendent. It was our opinion that we had corrected the problem identified by the board beyond any doubt, properly served everyone, and that the court would, in its attempt to save judicial resources, view that as, although a little bit late, eventually effective service, particularly in light of the fact that the board concedes there was no prejudice, the board concedes they had actual notice of a lawsuit, and given the policy behind the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure favoring resolution of cases on the merits, it seems to me that the case law and the rules favor our position in this case.
And then you didn't go back to Rand on a motion to reconsider.
No,
once
I did
you
not.
You got this adverse ruling.
That's right.
Given him this explanation either.
No, that's correct.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Ms. Hines. Mr. Horwitz?
Good morning. I'm here on behalf of the Milwaukee Board of School Directors. Your Honors, the plaintiffs never properly served this office.
What is the Office of Board Governance?
The Office of the Board of Governance is simply an administrative office. It's an office of secretaries. It's an office that serves the administrative functions of the Milwaukee Board of School Directors.
How close is it to the superintendent's office, physically?
It is in the same building. I don't know whether it's on the same floor or a different floor, but the administrative offices on Vliet Street in Milwaukee house many functions for the Milwaukee Public Schools. The Board of Governance serves the Milwaukee Board of School Directors. The superintendent's office is a separate and distinct office served by its own administrative staff.
What did the people in the Office of Board Governance do once they received the summons and complaint?
When they receive a summons and complaint, they file stamp it. They have a stamp that shows receipt by their office. They refer it then to the Office of Risk Management. Risk Management then makes certain that it's...
What I'm trying to get at here, this gets up to the superintendent, I would assume, or whoever is supposed to be properly
served. It does not, in fact.
Certainly gets to the city attorney.
It goes to the city attorney. It goes to the city attorney after it goes to risk management. The point of this matter, though, is that the plaintiff never attempted to serve a person.
Is the plaintiff told when the summons and complaint is dropped off, this is the wrong office, you have to go down the hall or the superintendent?
I'm not privy to the conversation between the private process server and the clerks who are in the office. What I do know, though, is that the plaintiff sent a summons and complaint on December 22 to the Office of the Board of Governance to serve the board. The plaintiff never attempted to serve a person, the president of the board. The plaintiff never attempted to serve the superintendent of schools.
Honestly, it's pretty technical. I mean, the city really, the school board had actual knowledge of the suit. The city attorney is on the case.
It may be technical.
This case, I don't know if it's got any merit or not, but to dump this thing on a service issue seems a little harsh.
It may seem technical in that all rules of process are technical as to who is served, but there is a policy behind it, and that is that to invoke the court's jurisdiction and bring a defendant before the court, the defendant is entitled to proper service, and that means the proper person is served, not just an office or a desk or a chair or somebody behind a door, but that the intention is to serve and present process to the person. And there is a policy, I think, behind it also in terms of accountability. If the superintendent is served, then the superintendent's office has a log of how many lawsuits have been served upon it. There is a certain level of accountability in a public function as to what public official is served with suit and how they account for how many times they're sued. That doesn't happen if it's just okay to walk the papers in, give them to anybody, and know that eventually they'll reach the hands of the attorney.
No doubt this was sloppy here. I don't question that. But
well,
it doesn't seem like it's very fair.
I would submit to the court that the question here is whether or not Judge Rando abused his discretion in not granting an extension. What Judge Rando was faced with was an argument that serving the Office of the Board of Governance was the equivalent of serving a chief executive officer. That simply doesn't hold water.
But he was also faced with the fact that the board had the notice. There's no problem with that. I mean, isn't this kind of an overreaction?
I think it's no more of an overreaction than it is in any of the other cases, such as Troxell, where there is, in fact, actual notice, and there's no prejudice shown to the defendant, and yet the plaintiff has failed to comply with the rules of procedure. if you don't have the rules of procedure, you may as well just say we can mail it, and that's not adequate. That doesn't comply with the rule. If actual notice is simply the only test, then let that be the only test in the federal rules, but it's not. Judge Randa had no equitable basis to relieve the plaintiff. Nothing was advanced to Judge Randa with respect to the waiting for the 115th day. Frankly, it really does not make a lot of sense, because even if a second suit on related facts with the same parties was anticipated, it was an inadequate response to say, I'll just wait until the midnight hour to serve this suit, when the second suit could be separately filed and then consolidated after service. Second of all, there is nothing here that indicates that the defendant did anything to evade service, was unavailable, there's nothing complicated in this. If you look at cases cited by the plaintiff, there is always some thread of some reason for discretion to be exercised to give the plaintiff a second or third chance at effectuating service. In Pania, which the appellant cites, a reason was advanced to the district court of, I didn't make it in time, but I was dealing with some personal issues with an aged parent, or I was dealing with a situation where there was, in other cases, where there was a change of corporate identity, and it was difficult to ascertain who the defendant was or where they resided or how to serve them. This was open, available, obvious, and there was no reason why service could not have been properly done within 120 days. The fact that the limitation period is ran is a consideration, and Judge Randa did consider that. The district court here did not fail to consider any of the relevant factors, and the district court made adequate and supported findings of fact. Ms. Coleman's counsel indicates that she served the superintendent within a few days after receiving the motion to dismiss. That is not true. The affidavits that were submitted by the board indicate that the board, in fact, the superintendent's office, in fact, was not served. The exhibit attached to Ms. Thompson's affidavit indicates that only the Board of Governance received that process on January 16th. I think that Judge Randa was willing to consider giving the plaintiff an extension until it was obvious that the plaintiff simply failed to understand a fundamental key issue of service of process, which is that you serve a person. You don't serve an office, you don't serve a counter, you don't serve a table, you don't serve a chair, you serve a person.
Well, who are the people that are entitled to receive service on behalf of the superintendent?
That was identified in affidavits. There's Nancy Petrowski, there's an assistant in the office, there's other designated clerks and assistants in the superintendent's office. It's not that, we're not arguing here that the superintendent, Spence Corte himself, had to receive process. Substitute service is available and is easy to effectuate. But the fact is that on January 16th, the process server did exactly the same thing he did on December 22.
Are the people who work in the Office of Board Governance under the direction of the superintendent?
No, they are not.
The superintendent can't fire them?
No, he cannot.
He can't?
No. They are employees of the Board of School Directors. Ultimately, the Board of School Directors is the employer in the sense of a Title VII case, and they are the proper party. There's no question about that with respect to the Title VII allegation. But under federal law, under the rules, if you cannot serve a chief executive officer, and there is no chief executive officer, then you serve according to state law. And the state law in Wisconsin is quite clear that for Milwaukee, the first class city, both the board president and the superintendent are to be personally served. The fact is that on an abuse of discretion, it means something more than what the Court of Appeals or another court might do if given the same facts. It's not to second-guess the district court's exercise of discretion, but to determine whether there's been an abuse of discretion, and that is whether or not there has been an error, indiscretion that is fundamentally wrong, that is totally arbitrary, unreasonable, and capricious. And that has not occurred in this case.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Horwitz. Okay, next case for argument, Marquis versus Federal Reserve.